One, two, three.
Wait, wait, wait. What's the first line again?
Help.
Oh, yeah.
One, two.
Help!
No, wait. Oh,
sorry.
One, two, three, four.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to A Journey Through Stock, Aiken and Waterman. I'm Gavin Scott from chartbeats.com.au, a little bit jet-lagged because I'm newly returned to Australia from a trip to the UK, the home of the music this podcast celebrates. Matthew Denby, how was your festive season?
It was a wonderful break, Gavin, thanks in part to those of you who wrote to us to say how much you enjoyed the Samantha Fox episode. As well as reading your messages, I've had plenty of time over the break to reacquaint myself with this period in the history of Stock, Aiken and Waterman. It was all happening in 1989, there was the resurrection of a certain massive pop icon, as well as the establishment of a brand new one. And there were also some key moments in 1989 that a lot of us would prefer to forget as well, all of which is coming up soon.
Yes, and we're shaking up the formula a little as we continue our journey through those singles produced by Saw in 1989. Over the next 3 weeks, we're going to take a look at three UK top 10 hits from three very different artists, one episode on each. And all three were released on the same day, February 13, 1989, and all of them have interesting backstories. Matt, what is the first of those backstories?
Yeah, it's a really good one. Bananarama were coming off the most successful period of their career in 1988 that had a run of classic hits with Saw and a mega successful greatest hits album. When they returned to the charts in February of 89, it was with a charity record with British comedy trio Dawn French, Jennifer Saunders and Kathy Burke, who were performing as La Nani Nini Nunu, a Bananarama parody act. This collaboration, a cover of the Beatles' classic Help, resulted in another UK top 10 smash. But unfortunately, it would be Bananarama's very last top 10 placement. Yes, there was a lot of trouble ahead. But before we get to all of that, let's have a listen to Help. That was Help by Bananarama and La Nani Nini Nunu. It was a massive success for the charity, Comic Relief, reaching number 3 in the UK and Portugal, 2 in Ireland, Sweden and Finland, 4 in Spain, 5 in Denmark, 6 in France and Norway, 8 in Germany and Switzerland, 9 in Belgium and 25 here in Australia. Comic Relief had been established by Richard Curtis and Lenny Henry back in 1985 in response to the Ethiopian famine, and it's raised millions through initiatives like Red Nose Day, which was a telethon, as well as comedy records like this one. And Help wasn't the first of those records, was it, Gavin?
No, this girl group Collision was the third official Comic Relief single, following the remake of Living Doll by Cliff Richard with the Young Ones in 1986, and a 1987 cover of Rockin' Around the Christmas Tree by Mellon Kim. No, not that Mellon Kim, comedian Mel Smith and singer Kim Wilde. And so a pattern had emerged of teaming actual singers with comic talent on a novelty record. Now, in 1989, another pattern was established, with the Comic Relief charity single being released in the lead up to Red Nose Day in March. So as for the comic talent Bananarama were teamed with, well, there was already a link between Sarah, Karen and Jackie and comedians Dawn French, Jennifer Saunders and Kathy Burke, weren't there, Matt? I'm not even going to try and say the name. I always get it wrong. Lanini Nudit. Anyway, I'll leave that to you. Anyway, what was the connection between the two girl groups, the real one and the fake one?
Yes, French and Saunders had already parodied Bananarama in their 1988 Christmas special, bringing in Kathy Burke to help make up numbers. She played a very Jackie-esque character called Kim. That spoof pulled absolutely no punches at all, so some people were a little bit surprised that Bananarama wanted anything to do with them after that. Let's hear a bit of that classic sketch, thanks to French and Saunders and the BBC.
Jimmy!
Stop.
It's you.
What?
What are you doing there?
I'm singing the song, aren't I?
Do it to me now, what you were doing then. Oh. Do it now.
Jimmy! Jimmy!
You're breathing in the middle of the word, yeah?
Well, how else am I going to get to the end of the word?
funny stuff. Now, the satire of Bananarama cut close to the bone, especially the attitude of French and Saunders' characters towards the new girl, who, as you said, was played by Burke, and also the group's tendency to dissolve into laughter during interviews was definitely sent up. It always felt like Bananarama were in the midst of an internal in-joke. And the comedians had a pretty good source for their info on the group.
Well, it certainly seems so. This sketch arguably gets a fair bit right, like Jackie's then love of drinking and her sometimes fraught outsider dynamic with the other two. Apparently, French and Saunders took their research quite seriously when they did parodies of bands, and they're always looking around for the inside goss in order to get things right. Dawn told True Confessions, the Bananarama fanzine, the idea of Bananarama's French and Saunders sketch came about because Jennifer and I were big fans of the group. We did lots of research while writing the sketch, which involved watching their The Tube interview with Paula Yates and speaking to our friend Mariella Frostrup, who was Bananarama's publicist at the time. And it also seems that Jackie had quite an interesting connection with the comedy team as well. She told the Fascinated with Garrod Farrelly podcast, quote, "I knew Kathy Burke. She used to go to the same drama school as my best friend. So she knew a bit about me. She would have known about me being sick and falling out of cars. French and Saunders know stuff. It's on the money. It's so good. It's so brilliant. People think I'd be upset, but it's hysterical and it's actually really close to the mark. They're kind of portrayed as a little bit bullyish, and me portrayed as not quite present and being sick and drunk. So that's about right." Unquote. In fact, far from being grossly offended, the girls all claimed in various interviews at the time that they loved the sketch, and when they were approached to do this charity single for Comic Relief not long after, apparently there were no hesitations.
Yes, Bananarama seemed to be up for being sent up, and along with the comedians, they all headed into PWL to record their charity collaboration. The song chosen for the occasion, as we've said, was Help, which was, of course, originally recorded by the Beatles. I'll find a change of mind and open up the doors. Help me if you can, I'm feeling down. And I do appreciate you being round. Help me get my feet back on the ground. The Beatles' original version of Help there, and not only did the lyrics of the song tie in with the aim of the release being to aid African relief efforts, but the song was fairly unchallenging vocally, with ample opportunities for comedy moments to be inserted throughout it.
Yeah, it was a brilliant choice of song. Often the Beatles were seen as completely off limits to cover. You'd just get crucified by the music press if you dared to go there. But Help seems to be a bit of an exception. There have been a couple of successful covers of that song. John Farnham did a really maudlin version in 1980, which went top 10 here in Australia, and then Tina Turner did a very similar arrangement on her Private Dancer album. But Bananarama did this fabulously joyous pop version, which I think is just so great. It nails it at being uplifting and fun. I was a big French and Saunders fan, so I enjoyed the comedy bits. The video was hilarious. I especially enjoyed La Nani Nini Nunu's dances, Gavin.
Yeah, the music video has some great moments, and I think this version is much more in keeping with the Beatles version than those, yeah, slower ballad type versions that you mentioned. There's a real sense of fun to this. I mean, it's not like they were covering Yellow Submarine or Get Back or something like that. This is from the Beatles' pure pop era, and so that was a pretty good match for Bananarama. Now, anyone who knows anything about me knows that I'm not a fan of comedy records, and I could definitely appreciate the humor of Help as a sketch. You know, I'd watch it a few times and get a giggle out of it, but I didn't want to listen to Help and all those down, down, downs all the way through it. Fun to hear once, but if I'm listening to a song, I want to enjoy it for its musical quality, not for the gags. So luckily, the B-side was a straight version of Help that had the dialogue snippets and bad backing vocals taken out. Let's have a bit of a listen to that.
Great stuff. Now, I had the 12-inch, which had another B-side, a comedy bit called Love in the Factory, which pretended to capture candid audio of the two bands meeting in the studio. And we've got some familiar themes cropping up again here. All I can say is poor Kim and poor Jackie. Let's have a listen.
Kim,
Music Union.
I'll tell members. You right now, you're out of the band. You're out of La Nani Nini Nunu.
What
next?
La Nani Nunu.
What next? La Nani Nini Nunu. You're out of it. You're out. You're just a disgrace.
Come on, go home. Go home, Kim.
We're going to have Jackie in our group. Oh, we're going to ask Jackie.
She
ask
Jackie to be in our group.
Jackie.
I'm ready.
Are you really unhappy in Banana Rama?
You could be in our group because we don't want him anymore.
You wouldn't want Jackie in the group. She's not very good.
Oh, no.
Right. Now, much bigger things eventually came out of this collaboration. A 90s pop culture juggernaut, in fact. French and Saunders became friends with the girls after making Help, and Jennifer says what she saw on their nights out together ended up directly inspiring some of the most excessive behaviour we saw not long after this from Patsy and Adina in Absolutely Fabulous. She told Graham Norton, quote, "Bananarama were the hardest drinking girls I'd ever met in the 80s. I'd never met girls who drunk so much. They would drink a bottle of vodka and go, come on, let's go party. And we used to go and party with them and just watch them. I remember one of them opening a cab door and coming out ass first and thinking it was the most brilliant thing. I just thought, I love that. I want to be that." And she did become that, didn't she, Gavin?
Well, she did. And of course, Absolutely Fabulous had their own comic relief single in 1994 when they teamed up with the Pet Shop Boys. That was a big hit, just like Help was. And by reaching number 3 in the UK, Help ties as Bananarama's biggest hit ever at home, along with Robert De Niro's Waiting and Love in the First Degree. So after their great run in 1988 that you mentioned, it looked like 1989 was just going to continue that with another massive hit for Bananarama. But instead of striking while the iron was hot and releasing another new single in the following months, Bananarama had other things on their mind, namely a world tour.
Yeah, a tour had been promised for many, many years, with plans thrown into chaos a few times by scheduling issues and pregnancies, and then the departure of Siobhan. But it finally happened in 89 with dates in Europe, North America, East Asia and Australia. And the tour was seen as a big success, finally ending Bananarama's reputation as a strictly studio-only act.
And as well as their biggest hits and a good chunk of the Wow album, Bananarama did perform one previously unreleased song on tour, which was a remake of Bon Jovi's You Give Love a Bad Name. But they didn't release that commercially. It feels a little bit like a wasted opportunity to me. Even if it had been a double A-side with a new song or something, I feel like that could have kept the momentum going for them. Instead, what did come out was a new Jack Swing remix of Cruel Summer by production team Blacksmith, titled Cruel Summer 89, that came out in the middle of the year. Yes, it was a top 20 hit in the UK, and I guess it worked as a stopgap measure to an extent, but Bananarama was starting to lose all momentum. Here is Cruel Summer 89. It's too close to come, but this heat has got right out of hand. It's a cruel, cruel summer, leaving me here on my own. It's a cruel. Okay, yeah, I agree. It would have been great to have something new to cash in on the tour, but I guess another cover wouldn't have been an ideal follow-up after, you know, Nathan Jones and then Help. I can't say this remix really weathers the test of time in the same way that the classic original version does, but it is an interesting curio from the time, which maybe does foreshadow the band's desire to move on from the Saw sound. Now, to be fair, the fact that there was no new music from Bananarama wasn't entirely for want of trying. There had been sessions at PWL to work on new music with Stock Aitken Waterman in 1988 and 1989, but those sessions hadn't yielded anything the group was happy to release.
Bananarama had been openly talking to the media back in 88 about how they were ready to fly the coop if Saw didn't change their sound soon. With the producers all over the charts with other artists at this point and a backlash building over their dominance, Bananarama didn't want to be associated with those acts or the Hit Factory sound. Karen complained that after the band had returned from their world tour, Saw had changed their way of working and the band no longer enjoyed the creative process, which they felt was now far less collaborative and more factory-like. Karen told DMA magazine, quote, "When we did Venus, the only hit they had was that Dead or Alive single. They were more than willing to sit down and write with us. It was very much a collaboration, a team effort. The people they were working with at the time all had their own sound. There was Rick Astley, Mel and Kim, and then there was us. But then everyone else got our sound. All of a sudden, you're hearing a record and you think, it's us, turn it up, and it's someone else. You know, it would be Donna Summer or Kylie, and it all just got too much." She also told Record Mirror of working with Saw, when you've been with them for a while, you know that they're playing you backing tracks that Kylie might have turned down. And if you turn them down, then Sonya might even get them. We like to feel a bit more exclusive than that. It's very annoying for us to be lumped in with the other groups that they've worked with who don't co-write with them and who are basically just fronts for Saw Records, unquote. Now, contrary to what we've heard from both Mike and Matt, Karen was pretty insistent to DMA that a lot of the happening music ideas on their hit records actually came from the band, and she was fed up with the way things were going. Quote, I think Mike Stock was a great songwriter and he was absolutely fantastic with melodies and harmonies and arrangements, but he wouldn't know what was currently happening, dance-wise and music-wise. That came from us, or even Peter to a certain extent. Our argument with them was, you may do this with different acts every day, but this is our album. I want to feel like it's special and personal to us. Their attitude was like, that's money in the bank, but it's more than that to me.
So there were a series of tracks that Bananarama did work on with Stock Aitken Waterman through 1988 and 1989. One of them was a track called One in a Million, which got as far as being performed in public. You can see it on YouTube. But despite that being the end result of a fairly tortuous process by which the song went through three completely different sets of lyrics and song titles, it was ultimately shelved. Let's have a listen to One in a Million.
But something in my heart said I must have you. Heaven must have sent you enough, enough. You must be one in a million.
That was One in a Million, a song that Bananarama worked on with Stock Aitken Waterman that was ultimately abandoned. And I have to say, I'm glad this track didn't receive an official release. It never really worked for me, whether as One in a Million or one of the alternate versions, Wake Up and Love Me or Love Generation. Those ooh, ooh, ooh bits, I find them particularly unpleasant. It doesn't feel like a new single to kick off the follow-up to Wow. It just wasn't strong enough. What did you think of that one?
Yeah, to me, this is on par with something like Bad for Me. It's a solid album track, but definitely not a killer lead single. It's interesting that things got to the point of the band doing promo for this song before it was scrapped. Karen told DMA, quote, we performed it once on a TV show in Italy and we hated it. We changed our minds about that one. Another scrapped track that came out of those sessions was I Don't Care. To my ears, parts of this song bear a passing resemblance to Bobby Brown's My Prerogative, you know, an artist who was really happening in music at that time. Let's have a listen.
Yes, the New Jack Swing influenced I Don't Care. This is more like it for me. It's still not up there with those Wow hits, but it's a solid album track. And in some ways, it feels a bit like a precursor for the Please Yourself direction. I mean, there's a variety of different mixes for I Don't Care, some which go down more of the New Jack Swing vibe and some which veer away from that to be a little bit more pop. And it feels like, yeah, they were trying everything with this song and it didn't really come together. The track did eventually see the light of day with a couple of mixes included as bonus tracks on the 2013 reissue of the Pop Life album. Now, a song that did make the original track listing of Pop Life in 1991, albeit as a CD bonus track, also originated from these 1989 sessions. Let's take a listen to Heartless. Now, this is the mix that made it onto Pop Life, although you can hear an earlier demo version on YouTube.
Right, Heartless. I found an interview where Karen didn't even know this track made it onto the CD. She seemed pretty dismissive of this song, actually. I think it's got some enjoyable moments, but again, it's a very long way from their best work from Wow. And I'm not the only one who thinks so. Phil Harding was pretty scathing of these sessions in his book, PWL from the Factory Floor. He wrote, listening to them all again recently, I can see why the girls on London Records were not happy, because they were very much covering old ground in terms of sound and direction. Or maybe the influence of Siobhan was missing during the writing sessions with Saw. They were not Saw's best songs or productions, and try as hard as we did during the mixing process, something was definitely lacking. Tracks like Heartless didn't really seem to have the life and energy of earlier tracks, and didn't seem to have the same stamp of tongue-in-cheek humour. Your thoughts, Gavin?
Now, for me, Heartless is the best of what Saw came up with for Bananarama in 1989. I'm not sure it should have been a single. It's quite moody and probably not up enough to have become a bigger hit than something like Only Your Love, but it was certainly worthy of being front and centre on Pop Life and not tucked away as a bonus track. I feel like it's quite sophisticated. I feel like it would have sounded quite good in the mix on Wow with songs like Come Back and Once in a Lifetime. It's not a joyous pop tune like Love in the First Degree or something like that, but I think it's really strong, and compared to things like One in a Million and I Don't Care, I feel like this is Saw finding finally, right, this is the way forward with Bananarama. Now we'll talk about a few more of the songs that were worked on during the late 80s in the bonus material, but with nothing single worthy being produced, Bananarama started to look elsewhere.
Bananarama's label mates on London Records, Fine Young Cannibals, had just had a global smash from working with Prince acolyte producer David Z on She Drives Me Crazy. So the girls flew off to America hoping for some of that same magic. Let's have a listen to the track that resulted, Some Boys. Right, that track might have been interesting, but it certainly wasn't going to follow the Cannibals to the top of the charts, and their collaboration with David Z didn't go any further. There was also some other work done with their old collaborator Steve Jolly, which resulted in one composition, Is Your Love Strong Enough, making the album. But the old magic wasn't there with him either. Gavin, what did you think of the David Z collaboration?
Yeah, I think it's all right. It popped up as well on that 2013 reissue of Pop Life, and, you know, it's good to hear it. It's interesting to hear what Bananarama were off doing when they weren't working with Stockacre Waterman or, as we'll hear shortly, Youth. But yeah, it's just something that's interesting to hear. I don't think it was the way forward by any stretch. So by early 1990, Bananarama were no closer to an album, and they found themselves back at PWL working with Saw on what has to be the biggest wasted opportunity in popular music history. Those swirling strings, those harmonies, that Happening All Over Again backing track, Ain't No Cure is one of the best, if not the best, Saw non-single of all time. There, I've said it. It is also one of the best things either Saw or Bananarama ever did. It would have been the perfect bridge from Wow and Love, Truth and Honesty to what was to come with Pop Life. And I will take no arguments on those points, but Matt, let's hear what you have to say.
Well, you're not going to get any, Gavin, because yay! I agree with you. Ain't No Cure is one of Saw's best ever songs. It sits proudly in my personal top 20 favorites. Everything about it is on point. The production, the harmonies, the lyrics. I just love those lines. You'll be back for more and you'll get hurt just like before. That really hits home. So why wasn't it a single? It is a minor pop tragedy that it never was. When the girls later moved on to Youth to produce the rest of the Pop Life album, they said they felt like they'd finally hit pay dirt creatively, and most of the Saw tracks they'd worked on were big. But Ain't No Cure was far too good to waste, and it stayed on the record. However, it seems like the band's urge to disassociate themselves from Saw meant the track took a backseat to Youth's material in the single schedule, and it was never ever lifted.
Now, we're not the only ones who are impressed by Ain't No Cure. Let's check in with Matt Aitken about this period of working with Bananarama and hear what he has to say about this song in particular. Here is Matt.
There Ain't a Cure for Love. That's one of the best tunes we ever wrote.
Agreed.
It's just brilliant.
Was there a noticeable shift after that kind of runner hit you had with them, when it was like, okay, we've done the Wow album, we've done the Greatest Hits collection, we're going to start a new project, and then eventually they went off and worked with Youth?
Oh, well, there you go. Well, I've no idea about that. I know is that I would have gone on working with Bananarama forever, making records with them. And I happen to think Wow is a brilliant album. Well, certainly by our standards, this is a brilliant album. But so they obviously had some other beer in their bonnet. Who knows?
But those tracks that you did do with them, like One in a Million and I Don't Care and Ain't No Cure, you know, what was the vibe like around then, if you remember? Do you remember, was it a different kind of atmosphere compared to working on Wow? Or, I mean, I guess Siobhan had left and Jackie was around by then.
No, I didn't notice. I have no particular recollection. I think we thought we were making better records with them. I think we thought. Was Heartless part of that group?
Heartless, yeah.
Yeah, Heartless, you know, people just fall over listening to that. I think we were on the cusp of something really quite good there. It might not have been, well, would it have been? It could conceivably have been as good as Wow or better. Who knows? But as we never got really chance to get where we were going, we'll never know.
Although Ain't No Cure was clearly the best thing Saw had offered Bananarama in months, the group took the unusual step of taking the song with them when they started working with Youth.
Yes, they did a total re-record of the track with Youth. They obviously loved the song, but wanted it to fit in with the overall sound of the rest of the tracks on the album. I love the Youth version too. It really shows up the greatness of Saw's songwriting, the way the track still translated so very well with his much more organic sound behind it. Let's have a listen to his version. Great stuff, I love that. Although I have to say, Mike Stock got much better harmonies out of the girls than Youth did. Now, when PWL were informed that most of their material was being dumped from the album, with the added indignity of Ain't No Cure being totally reproduced, they were naturally very pissed off. PWL reacted to the slight by quickly recording a new version of Ain't No Cure, this time with girl group Delage, which they threatened to release in response. Let's hear that version.
That was one of a couple of different versions of Ain't No Cure recorded by Delage, and we'll talk about their versions in more detail when we get to that group on the podcast, but that one was a fairly faithful rendering of the song compared to the Bananarama version.
Right, and whether it was because of PWL's reaction to their re-recording of the song with Youth, or just the need for some continuity from the Wow era, the Nanas did end up including the Saw version of Ain't No Cure on their album instead of Youth's, but Youth's came out many years later as a bonus track on a reissue.
Okay, we've heard Youth's name mentioned a few times already. Let's talk about Bananarama going to work with Youth.
Yeah, while the Saw sessions may have been unsatisfactory for the band, they did love working with Youth, who they say was much more receptive to their ideas, even putting Seagulls on one track. They also felt that he wasn't working to what they regarded as a formula. Sarah told Smash Hits, "We just felt we needed a change, and with Youth we got to try out all sorts of different things." Karen told Hit CD, "Working with Youth was like going back to basics. It was exciting, and Youth had never actually tried to write pop songs before. It wasn't like working with Mike Stock, who could sit down and play any song you named."
So finally, in mid-1990, after these sessions with Youth, Bananarama released a brand new single, Only Your Love. Now, in many ways, this should have worked. With the Saw sound of 88 and 89 out of favour, and Dance and Madchester having taken over the charts, this was an attempt to move with the times. But was it too big a leap? Or had there been too big a gap since the Nanas' last single? Let's have a quick listen to Only Your Love.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good track. But Only Your Love only got to 27 in the UK and 49 in New Zealand. It did a bit better in Italy, getting to 21 there. So what went wrong? I tend to think that most of the more alternative fans that the band had at the very start of their career had long since moved on and been replaced by a much younger, Saw-loving set with Wow. A lot of the gay fans were still with them, being typically loyal to the band and willing to change with them. But would the early 90s indie dance set embrace the new Bananarama? Apparently not many of them did. Karen admitted that the band's pure pop reputation probably stopped a lot of people buying their stuff with youth. She told Record Mirror, "It's very difficult for people to accept that we might be hip and trendy. I'm sure there are a lot of people just itching to go out and buy Only Your Love because they liked it, but they couldn't quite make themselves do it because it was Bananarama." The rather experimental Tripping in Your Love was planned as the next single, but got pulled in favour of the more commercial Preacher Man, which came out in December 1990 after a long delay following Sarah's bout with meningitis. Let's have a listen to that.
As much as I like Trippin' on Your Love, and I do like Trippin' on Your Love, it was the right decision to go with Preacher Man. It was a much stronger single and returned Bananarama to the UK top 20. It's easily their best post-Saw effort, and I can't help but wonder what might have been if the group had gone from Ain't No Cure to Preacher Man to Only Your Love as part of a period of transition. That would have worked, right?
It might have. Well, Preacher Man is just sublime. It's one of my favourite ever Bananarama records. If a track that good wasn't going to make the top 10, you know something really big had happened. The Pop Life singles were all brilliant in my opinion. Although the production was very hip and aiming at credibility, the songs themselves were still all extremely strong. They were all well-constructed commercial pop tracks with great melodies and big choruses, which is what Bananarama fans should have wanted. These singles all deserve to be hits, but I think, unfortunately, Bananarama just got caught in a major epoch shift. The musical landscape was changing radically by the start of the early 90s. Many big 80s acts were very suddenly seen as passé as we hit the new decade, and perhaps also the Nanas had just reached the natural end of their lifespan as a mass-market top 10 pop act. Some of their longtime fans were no doubt aging out of buying singles. I mean, they'd gone through a full cycle of teenagers by this point, and other fans were just naturally growing into different things in the 90s as the culture changed. I think the band was definitely right to try to evolve, but sometimes when the landscape is shifting this much and your brand is seen in that moment as being out of date, good songs just aren't enough.
I mean, Preacher Man was good enough for Siobhan, who performed that track from after her time on the reunion tour a few years ago. It was a really fantastic single, and I do wonder what it would have taken for Bananarama to keep having the type of hits they had in the 80s in the 1990s. But I stand by the theory that had they kept the momentum going with singles in 1989 and into the start of 1990, it would have been easier for them to do a Kylie and transition their sound to something a little bit more mature. Now, two more singles were released from Pop Life, a remake of Long Train Running by the Doobie Brothers, and the eventual release of the much remixed Tripping on Your Love. Now, we're going to talk about them when we look at the album in more detail in the bonus material. For now, though, let's hear from Youth, who, if you will remember, we spoke to about his days as one of Brilliant way back at the start of this podcast. We also asked him about the Pop Life project, and here is what he had to say.
I ended up producing Bananarama after him. That was a very tough gig.
Because they were coming out of Stock Aitken Waterman.
That's right, yeah. Well, I'd known them. We were friends before they'd done that, when they were doing before Fun Boy 3 and stuff, and loved them. You know, I love what they did. I thought what they did with Stock Aitken Waterman was genius as well. Fantastic. So when I got asked to do that, and Siobhan had left, which was a bit weird, although Jackie was an old friend. Jackie had been working in Boy in the King's Road in 77, 78, with where my first girlfriend worked, Joe Hargreaves. So I'd known her a long time. But the whole Bananarama show is run by Sarah, really, and with Karen as her ever-attended sidekick. And, you know, anyone else that gets in the way of Sarah, they get pushed to the side, you know. Sarah's very focused. She knows what she's doing with that. And I think what we wanted to do was not try and... I made a point of not trying to go anywhere where PWL had been because there was no point. They'd done it so well. So we just tried to bring it into a different kind of contemporary thing. Acid House was going on, getting the Gypsy Kings involved, you know, making it more of a Balearic thing. Of course, that album, it wasn't as successful as the PWL ones, but where it was most successful was Spain. And a big part of my navigation on that album was Ibiza and the Balearic sound. And the Spanish love pop, you know, and putting that pop into the dance music, that was the Balearic thing, really, you know, and broke down again lots of barriers.
I think that album was ahead of its time.
Very ahead of its time, out of its time. And yeah, I think it still stands up. I mean, it did okay, did pretty well, but it was hard, I think, for them coming off the success of PWL to see it as a huge success, because it was always going to be eclipsed by the PWL years. But nevertheless, it's part of their story and journey.
Okay, great to hear from Youth. With Pop Life underperforming on the charts, change was definitely in the air, and that included Jackie leaving the band. She recalled the build-up to that situation in her chat with Garode Farrelly on his Fascinated podcast. Quote, I began to get very unhappy with being sidelined so much. That feeling of being fed that I'm not as good as, and them two knowing each other so well. I got more and more distant, so I flipped the self-destruct button in the band. So I'd be off partying and not turning up to interviews. I flew my own mates everywhere and they didn't particularly like that. So it started to implode a little bit. I was very unhappy and they were wanting to change a little bit. There was a phone call to come over. Sarah wasn't there, obviously, but Karen always does the dirty work. So Karen sat me down. It was hard, but I was kind of relieved and sad at the same time. Like, what do I do now? Unquote. From this point onwards, Bananarama would be reduced to a twosome, the way Karen and Sarah apparently always wanted it. And we'll be encountering them again on this journey when we get to the post-Aitken era, when they return to PWL for their next album, Please Yourself.
Oh, Jackie, we barely knew you. Now, I think what happened with Bananarama in 1989 and 1990 was the squandering of their position as one of the UK's top pop acts. They were at the top of their game. I agree, they weren't necessarily being given Saw's best material, but when Saw did deliver the goods in the form of Ain't No Cure, it was just the type of track, like Happening All Over Again and Better the Devil You Know, that could have given both Saw and Bananarama another big hit. Sadly, that wasn't to be.
Yeah, I agree. The song is definitely in the league of those two amazing, wonderful songs you just mentioned. The Pop Life era has only grown in esteem for me as the decades go by. I think it's probably my favourite album of Bananarama's. It was a big shame to see Bananarama's hit era with Saw come to an end, but it was all changed by the early 90s. And we're going to see the groundwork laid for that tidal wave of change in 1989, especially with our next episode.
Oh, yes. You've all been waiting for it. We've been waiting for it. We are going to get to I'd Rather Jack by the Reynolds Girls in the next episode. One of the most contentious singles in the Saw catalogue. Yes, it wasn't a number one hit, but there's so much controversy and so much to say about this song that we're giving it its own episode. So we'll see you in a week to talk about I'd Rather Jack. Until then, as always, come and find us on social media, rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, if you would be so kind, if you haven't already done so. And Matt, what are we going to be doing in the bonus material for this episode?
We are going to be talking about a whole bunch of tracks from the aborted Saw sessions of 88, 89. And we're also going to be talking about Pop Life. So do pop on over.
Now, to listen to the bonus content for this episode and every episode of A Journey Through Stock Aitken Waterman, head to chartbeats.com.au/saw. And you can subscribe to listen to that.
I also want to shout out to Ross, one of our wonderful listeners who helped me out with some of my research with some of his amazing liner notes that he sent me. Thanks so much, Ross, and thank you to everybody actually who's helped with this podcast. Been a great crowdsourcing of information amongst the fan community.
We'll see you in 7 days' time for a little bit of AM, FM, all that jazz. Bye, everybody.
See you later, everyone.
It's in the can.
It's a wrap.
Shut up, Kim.